Looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank? The new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look in a premium gold luxe packaging. It's all about panoramic volume and fully fanned out lashes. With its tapered brush, the new Panorama Mascara catches every single lash, giving you the false lash look without any of the hassle. Say goodbye to clumps and flakes, because this mascara is specially formulated to resist them all day with up to 24-hour wear. And the best part? It performs better than Luxe mascaras at only a fraction of the cost. You can buy Panorama Mascara on Amazon today.
Hi, I'm George Chen, and you're listening to SupDoc, a show where we talk about documentaries with guests from the worlds of comedy and film. On this episode, I spoke with documentary director William Badgley. Badgley has made two music documentaries and is wrapping up his third film about the crucial link between London's punk and reggae subcultures, DJ, archivist, and filmmaker Don Letts. I was able to catch an in-progress cut of the Letts film Rebel Dread at the Echo Park Film Center, so there's some talk about that version, which will be different by the official release. You may be more familiar with his other films that are available on streaming services, Kill All Redneck Pricks, a film about the band Carp, and Here to Be Heard, The Story of the Slits. Both bands were hugely influential in vastly different ways for different generations. Carp has a small but mighty cult following, especially for the 90s Pacific Northwest, the scene that Badgley grew up in. The Slits were a wild band of young women in the first wave of UK punk. They broke up in the early 80s, then reformed with two principal members in the aughts, and kept touring until the death of singer Ari Up in 2010. Here to Be Heard can currently be found streaming on Hulu, and Kill All Redneck Pricks can be found on Amazon Prime. And now here's my interview with William Badgley. Yeah, you know, I just, I've seen all the films. Hi, Bill Badgley. You go by Bill?
William? Bill is great. Yeah.
Bill is how I've heard all my friends refer to you as Bill.
Yes.
And
in person, it's Bill. I always use William on like paper and stuff like that. But yeah, it's Bill.
And, and you, we saw your latest thing, your latest film. I don't know how much we can talk about that. What do you feel about it? Talking about that.
No, that's totally fine. But I want to clarify, not a premiere, an in-progress.
An in-progress. I got to see an early screening because of our mutual friend telling me that you're going to do that at Echo Park Film Festival, which is a Rebel Dread film about Don Letts.
Exactly.
But if our listeners may have seen your two other films, which are all, you're kind of like the music doc guy for a certain type independent punk kind of thing. So Here to Be Heard, the film about the Slits, and Kill All Redneck Pricks, the film about Carp.
Yep.
Two of my favorite bands.
Oh, nice.
And also, like, I really liked Big Audio Dynamite. I think I'm in maybe in America, maybe a little bit of a minority in being a fan of that band.
I've been hearing more about Big Audio Dynamite from people than I expected to hear.
Yeah, because it's definitely of its era. I don't know how...
The other stuff is so... famous,
right? Oh, you mean like the Clash?
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, because there's a bunch of the interesting thing about the Don film for me was that you jump from band to band because that's what he was doing. Mm-hmm. Like normally what I do, obviously, is settle in on a 90-minute narrative about one band. But since this is about an individual who's involved with many different bands, the film is hopping around. Mm-hmm. So of all of those choices, there's the Clash, Sex Pistols, even a bit of like fashion from the early London 70s scene. There's so many things that get touched on. It's funny at the end of it for people to go, the finger lands on Big Audio Dynamite. And I'm just like, that's so rad. That's cool.
Yeah. Were you a fan of that band? Or did you just meet him through doing the Slits documentary?
I met Don through doing the Slits film. We got a bunch of archival from him. He gave us a really great deal, which is, key because Don owns about half of the Slits archival, at least half, maybe more.
When you say own, because he shot it. Because it's his 16mm footage?
Okay. Because he shot it. That's how that works.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. If you're like, 15-year-old kid walks into a show in 1975 with a camera, you are the owner.
like the Grateful Dead bootleg kind of situation.
Yeah, and you talk to guys, because I talk to a lot of these guys to film this stuff. You know, some of them are, you know, living in a house on the beach, you know, because it's in some of those scenes, if you're walking around at that time, you're getting stuff that, like, that's what you do for a living now, is sell that stuff, because it's, you know, like London in the middle 70s, that's quite a cross reference of things that you could have potentially been shooting that people would be really interested in.
Yeah, I was thinking about that because both the Slitz film and Don Letts film was really living in that birth of punk era. And like, I think the two places that people just can't get enough of at this point in time seems to be like London around 76, New York 77.
Which Don did both.
He did both, right? He was everywhere.
There is kind of a funny thing in the movie where it becomes not a versus type situation, but, you know, there's large sections of the film that are very much like located in London, and then large sections of the film that are also like very much located in New York, which is, I think, fun. I think one of the cool things is that it doesn't compare the two punk scenes.
Your film doesn't, right?
No, not at all, because they sort of do London punk, where they're bringing together reggae and punk, and then they go to New York, and there's this great line in the film that Don says where he's like, and now it's about punk and hip hop, you know, right. and so it, like, this thing just keeping going, but it's always fun to London and New York go well together. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, I lived in New York for 13 years and I spent a lot of time in London, and people always say that there requires no translation. Like, if you love London, like LA and New York, lots of translation. LA and London, lots of translation. But if you get along well in either London, you know, or New York, the other one, easy peasy.
You either learn to live very cheap or you're already loaded. I think those are two things.
Just a very similar way of communicating those two cities.
Right, right.
Yeah.
I could see that. And I think what I was thinking when watching the Don Letts film is just about, because it definitely is about how this generation of Jamaican immigrants like kind of failed to integrate into the UK. And I was thinking about how that American hardcore is sort of divorced from the black roots of music in a way.
Oh, right.
It's
American
hardcore is sort of like white suburban kids, like kind of trying to like take all the edge, and then kind of losing like any sort of the blues based elements of rock music.
Yeah. I mean, that's a really interesting thing about the Don story. I mean, for me, particularly as an American growing up in the shadow of punk, and certainly in the middle of like post-punk and post-punk, whatever you want to call it, is that it didn't happen here.
Yeah.
The punk reggae thing didn't happen here.
Not till Sublime.
Well, yeah. And so I was
Long
like,
Beach core.
Yeah. I was like, you know, this would make all my friends in the UK just like totally cringe. But like when I was coming out of the grunge thing, going to college, having my own bands, reggae amongst everybody that I knew in the music scene was like blacklight poster, college kid, like completely clueless. From the middle of America, like taupe carpets, stucco walls, smoking a joint and wearing flip flops and talking about Bob Marley, which is like so like upsetting once you find out about these people. And then, you know, when you find out about them, you see like, oh, of course this happened. And how beautiful it is and how wonderful it is. But it's just kind of funny because it just did not happen in the U.S.
Right.
So it's a fun story to tell in the sense of, especially in the U.S., of saying like, hey, you know, like kind of, which is a great thing docs just do in general, is sort of knocking on the door and being like, psst, like, look at that.
Yeah. And like the reggae punk overlap is obviously like a lot of the heart of the Slitz story, I think.
Yeah.
Too. Yeah.
Definitely.
And I wanted to know more about this period when Ari was living in Jamaica, or I guess she was like commuting between Jamaica and New York,
you know, it's funny kind of that you should 90s. Say that because our original, one of the original ideas for the film was to make a film just about Ari.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? And
which at that time you were working on this, she had already passed on.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, yeah. So. Exactly. And so we didn't end up doing that. Decided to make a film about the band instead. But when we got to that part, there's a few sentences about it, but she basically just like leaves and comes back because it's told from the point of view of the band. But that like sort of leave and come back that happens in the movie in like 2 minutes is like 15 years and could easily be its own film.
Right.
Because I mean, it probably should be its own film.
Can't find a lot about it. Just like, you know, Googling about it this period where she's like, you know,
I don't think it's Googleable information.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
You know, I think, you know, some of it literally happens in the jungle in the beginning part of it, you know, where she's literally like, you know, barefoot and pregnant in the jungle and goes off and has these two kids. But then when it goes to Jamaica, it's Jamaica, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's dangerous, you know? You know, it just depends on how far you want to get into that stuff, you know, and who you want to believe and like all the rest of it. But there's a lot going on. I mean, okay. Jamaica is a very, you know, complicated place.
I would imagine you had insider access to any sort of home movies or home film from that period, though, right? Or would that have gone through her kids, or how, where is that stuff?
I think some through her kids, some through friends. Mm-hmm. I didn't spend a lot of time on it because we decided sort of early on, you know, for better or for worse, that we were going to make a Slits film. And it's always the case. And it was the case as well with the Dawn film. It's been a case on every film I've worked on, is that you're making a film about an interesting person, hopefully. Interesting people are surrounded by other interesting people. So there's a lot of opportunity to get sidetracked. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And the one thing a film really can't do is get sidetracked.
Right.
You know, I mean, so it's always this dance of like showing to people a lot of different stuff and going off the rails.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, so, and even inside the band, in Kill All Redneck Pricks, there was a member that I felt constantly trying, not him personally, but just his subject matter, trying to derail the film to be about him. And I had to just kind of like just smash. I would, in my mind, I would think about like just trying to like put my hand on his head and being like, you cannot only be in a third of this movie. You cannot be in 98% of this film because you're only 33% of this band.
Yeah.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Byte Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
So working on the Don Letts film must feel, is it more liberating in a way to just have the focus?
Oh my God. To concentrate on one person. That was the first thing I thought when I knew we were going to do this film. I was like, oh my God. Only one storyteller. How awesome is that? Because usually there's like four people telling a totally contradictory stories. But that to me is not even the hard part. It's that the hard part with four is that they legitimately have four different stories. Mm-hmm. And so even some flack I got on the Slitstock was, you know, that like it went down too many different roads with too many of the different people. And it's like, but all these people are in this band.
Oh, right, right. Because I guess the Mark, the 2000s version of the band, there's only two original people. And then you have a lot of interview footage with like the other people that were later in the band too.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Like, and the people that started the band, like the other the members.
I mean, I just chose to stay in the band.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and we did. And that being said, we did follow the side roads of the band members who left a bit. And then we came back to them in the end. And you're never going to make, you know, everybody happy. I mean, one of the interesting things about music docs that I've been, or music films just in general, this really was spawned on by the reaction that Bohemian Rhapsody was getting, and I was paying attention to it and looking at it. So, was this thing that it's this really interesting set of parameters that a music doc faces that a narrative film does not face. Like, could you imagine if Star Wars came out in 1977 and everybody had already decided what Star Wars was like for 15 years before opening night? Narratives don't face this. Mm-hmm. But we face this every single time we put out a movie, is that everybody has already decided in their bedroom alone 10 years earlier what this band is about. Mm-hmm. So when you do opening night, you're going up against all of that. Mm-hmm. And that's just a completely unique set of circumstances for music films, which I just think is really interesting.
Right, because it's so personal. The people's relationship to the music is so personal.
Absolutely the reason.
Right.
Yeah.
But in the case of something like Carp, where it's like they were huge to a small group of people.
Very small group.
So when it's more like this is a chance to introduce them to be.
A very small but very energetic group of people. This is true. I have to say, still getting emails from them. They're very, I call them carp heads.
Yeah.
They're hardcore.
I mean, it's sort of like what people say about the Velvet Underground, right? They only played so many shows with so many people, but then everyone started a band. It's like, there's a lot of bands that sound like Carp, like still.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. You know, they just had, they were the band I saw the most times on purpose of any band.
Yeah.
And they just, you know, like I think, hopefully that the film makes clear, it was a story about a friendship.
Yeah.
And it's just such a good example of that.
There was I considered myself a fan, and there were sort of like outlines of some things that I had heard about, but like I did not expect what I saw in the film. Like,
yeah, and that was a story that I think Northwesterners knew.
Right.
You know, like the Northwesterners in the music scene knew.
Yeah.
I
knew about like the suicide attempt, and then I knew that, and they also, You've done two films where major components of the film are people that are not available for direct interviews.
Yeah, right.
So in two of your films, it's
not
like that's
currently
it's
living.
It's a hard thing to kind of just have.
Yeah,
archival.
And I think the approaches of those two were totally different. Mm-hmm. The first one was somehow it seemed from the stories that I've or things I've been hearing people say, we somehow got away with. It not really dawning on you when you watch it that he isn't there until he dies. So it's like dancing on this really interesting timing where as soon as you're about to like, hey, wait a second, you know, it's like, oh, he's dead. You're like, oh, shit. Oh, fuck.
Yeah.
You know, like you're just like,
did you see Three Identical Strangers?
I did, yeah.
Yeah, it's like that question comes up like right away. I'm just like, okay, there's these guys.
Oh, what? Totally over my head.
you didn't think about it. Oh, you did?
No, because they look so, I'm a big picture guy. I'm a macro guy. Don't do details. Yeah. So I was just like, I could not keep straight who I was. As far as I'm concerned, I saw three brothers.
Okay.
Because they all looked exactly the same. And they're cutting back and forth between these two guys, right? Yeah. And in my like macro mind, I can't. I'm seeing like, you know, everything they're talking
about.
Okay.
So, okay. Yeah. No, I guess
completely fooled me. Yeah. No.
That flew over your head. Now there is like a rumor. There's two rumors that I've heard about Carp that maybe you would know.
Sure.
The stories. The first one is that they had done a cable access show. I feel like you would
beef.
Oh, They did. That was a rumor that I'd heard. And yeah, I'm
it's
like,
in the film.
It is in the film.
It's in the film. There's footage from that. Also, on the we did a fifth anniversary DVD.
Oh, okay.
Double DVD release that I do not have any copies of. It was on there. As well.
Okay. Okay. I think it was not in the film.
It is just literally Wayne's World.
Right. Okay. It's just them in a base.
Like, okay. Here's a really interesting story. So when I was touring the film in England, we did a bunch of theatrical screenings of that film too. I think 70 in 10 countries. And when we screened it in, it was not in England. It was in Wales.
Okay.
In the back of this bar, they just didn't want to go home after it was over. It was like, I think it was in Cardiff or Newport.
And
anyway.
No, they never toured Europe, did they?
No.
They never got over there. Okay, so it's all just fans.
So we're
fans,
sitting in this bar. Everybody's drinking, and we watched the movie, and then they just didn't leave. And so I was like, well, I don't know what you guys want to do now, because I just showed you the movie, and literally no one was leaving. So they were just like, well, what else you got? And I was like, I don't know. And I just started like pulling out like this stuff, and we watched Beef.
Okay.
And their minds exploded. They were like, the parts of their brains were left on the walls in that room because they don't have, I mean,
public access. Yeah.
No, I mean, that's a completely American thing. I mean, you know, they have actual public access, which is the BBC, right?
Right.
But our weird little version of it is completely alien to them, but at the same time, super interesting to them because of Wayne's World.
Oh, right. Okay.
Right. So all of these people had seen Wayne's World, and they, I think in their minds where they were like, this is Hollywood.
Right.
And then I was literally walking up to them and being like, this is not Hollywood. That was a document. Wayne's World is a documentary.
You know, right. What I mean? Penelope Spheeris made it. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And they were just like, whoa. Like they couldn't get past
so
that.
So I'm unclear on which footage it was. Like not the practice footage. I'm trying to think
it
of
is
like
sort
which
of
footage.
Practice okay. footage because yeah. I don't know. I can't remember now. That movie came out so long ago. Because
I've like, never
I,
seen
I can't remember
Beef.
Now.
I didn't know the name of it. I just heard that they did it and people kind of describe. Do you know Zach Carlson?
Oh, yeah.
I feel like maybe I heard about this from Zach Carlson, maybe some
Sounds
other people.
Correct.
Yeah. Like, I'm like, those guys, I don't know. I just, the first time I ever saw them, I was just like so confused by their deal. I'm like, it's very goofy. They're very goofy.
Oh, very goofy, but don't sound goofy.
They don't sound goofy.
Goofy.
Yeah, right. Are goofy while sounding pretty.
Well, and that was the whole sort of magic of the shows was the sugar and the salt, because it was like the music obviously was very aggressive, but then in between it was literally like slapstick.
Right. Like that recording, that KXLU recording where they're just riffing in between everything.
Just,
yeah.
Literally just three nerds. Yeah. That are way too comfortable with each other. They're practically dating the way that young, you know, kids can do. Mm-hmm. You know, that are just like jabbing and poking, and there's no. And also, I think it plays into this thing in Olympia that was changing at that time, was that in the Northwest, and I've even dealt with this since I've moved to Los Angeles, is that in the Northwest, you just assume that no one is watching. Like in that time period, you assume that no one you're talking to is ever going to be famous, ever was famous, ever will be famous, including yourself. And so you just say whatever stupid thing pops in your head all the time. And even since I've been here, I've just been like, oh, you know, you should think about what movies you slam at the bar. Because I've literally,
around you, yeah.
Yeah, I've literally had a situation where I was, when I first moved here, I was knocking this film and the guy was like, oh yeah, I worked on that for 3 years.
Oh.
And you're just like, oh, that's, now what do we do? Okay, well, do we just stand here for a while and then I'll just leave or what? Like, how does this work?
Yeah, coming from the Bay Area, I guess that would be like me talking shit about Uber in a bar. But then if someone was like, hey, I worked there, I'd be like, yeah, listen to what I said.
So I think they had a bit of that going on where they were just kind of like, you know.
They're kids,
there's
right?
no filter.
Yeah.
You know, and then of course that changed in a huge way is that there were people nationally and internationally looking at this tiny little town in Washington. mm-hmm. Which is what made it get really interesting and also tragic.
Yeah. And you never lived in Olympia.
I did. Yeah.
Oh, you did live there.
Yeah. I lived there sort of post. I lived there in 1995.
Okay.
94 was essentially the year that that scene was like attacked, quote unquote, by the rest of probably mostly like the West Coast, mm-hmm. but possibly the entire country. Some would argue the entire world. I was, you know, from the state and had been visiting there for shows for a while. So I don't know if I would necessarily be grouped into those numbers, mm-hmm. but it was when it started, the worm has turned. If you've heard that expression,
yeah.
You know what I mean? It was starting to get like different.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Like people moving there to try and make it or something.
Yeah, it changed everything.
Yeah. So you had been, or did you had an interest in film the whole time as well? Or
no.
You doing, no. So film, there's a radical change at some point.
For me, it's just stories. Mm-hmm. And story can take many shapes. You know, music, as we just discussed, films, paintings. I don't paint, but, mm-hmm. you know, anything. It can be anything. And to me, the story is important. I hope to end up writing a book at some point. To me, that's like the really tough one.
Mm-hmm.
I just started writing screenplays, which is interesting because I wrote a lot of, a lot of people don't know this or they don't think about it, but we write scripts for docs, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Like we write outlines and we write scripts. And so the interesting thing I've seen recently, like I credited myself as a writer for the films, because to me, that's a very legitimate acknowledgement of the work that goes into it. Mm-hmm. I didn't start it. Who started it? Oh my God. Inside Job, the financial crisis film.
Uh-huh.
They credited their editors as co-writers. And I was like so impressed that they did that. But then I was reading, which you should never do. I was reading reviews of Here to Be Heard the other day. And this guy was like, I don't know why he says, I can't help but do him in this voice. He's like, I don't know why it says writer on there. He didn't write anything. Oh. And it's just like, I think it speaks out of a gross misunderstanding of what writing means in documentary. I don't do this, but I wanted to type back like, so how do you feel those sentences got in that order? I just want to hear your take on how you feel like they just magicked together.
Yeah.
Because in documentary, that's writing the story.
You're definitely like you got to log everything. You got to log all the interviews. You got to conduct the interviews. You got to do, and also
media
I think,
organization. Yeah, that's
yeah a and huge you other part. Were doing in the Don Letts film. I'm assuming these are gonna all be in there. Like you have I don't know if you, what do you call it, reenactments. Yeah, reenactments. Because you haven't really done that with the other films.
No,
at all.
Sort of did it in the Carve Talk.
Oh, is there some reenactment stuff?
Yeah, it's like hands and feet type stuff.
Oh, okay.
But yeah.
I always miss those. Like people always have to point them out to me. Like when we interviewed Ronnie Asher, he's like...
You know, now that I think about it, I don't know if any of them remained in. Mm-hmm. I don't know that they did. We did a lot of location heavy stuff in there. They sort of did. They did in the van.
Okay.
Because there's shots of the van driving around and stuff. But yeah, no more
with the set though. With the Don Letts, there's like stuff on a set.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We did a black box like
you're directing actors.
Yeah, and
is
that's
that your first time directing actors?
it is, other than music videos.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, and I went straight to the dumbest thing they say you could possibly do, which is to direct kids.
Oh right. Yeah.
And it was really funny because I had a really interesting problem on that set, which I would have never seen coming, which is that the kid that played the young Don is about 8 years old, and it's heavy stuff. It's like about this racist political speech coming out and basically obliterating the sort of non-racial environment that they were living in, which there's the dribble down racism that the kids are spouting from the parents.
Mm-hmm.
Like they're coming to school and all of a sudden they're hearing all these terrible terms, which are listed in the film. And they're directing, Don says, I was no longer their pal, Letzy. I was you, black bastard.
Mm-hmm.
It was just such a powerful line. And so this child actor, you know, we didn't go into gory details with him, of course, but it was like, you know, we're going to do these scenes and they're going to be serious, you know, and Elvin, I want you to, you know, be serious. And this was such a happy kid. Aww. I felt like a monster being like, Elvin, you gotta quit smiling, man. I was like, you gotta quit smiling. I'm like, so what I'm doing for my job today is just ruining this wonderful child. Like, that's all I'm doing here today. Just being like, we had to do take after take after take. Yeah. He's just like,
looks sad.
Huge, just shit-eating grin on his face. He's like the happiest eight-year-old I have ever met in my life. Oh, but man. We managed to like... It was easy to select takes because, well, this is the only one that Elvin is not smiling in.
Oh,
so, but yeah, he was great. And also, this is really interesting. He was terribly afraid of matches. You know that scene where he lights the desk on fire?
Oh, yeah.
It took me over an hour to get him to light that match.
Oh, just
he's so afraid of it.
Right. Just even that. Yeah.
And somebody brought up the point that, like, I was like, doesn't it seem weird to anybody else that an eight-year-old boy is like, isn't that the classic, like, you got to keep an eight-year-old boy away from matches? And they were like, yeah, but this is like, you know, iPads world. They were like, they don't do that anymore.
Right, yeah.
And I was like, what? My mind was blown on that one. I was like, okay, that's cool.
Yeah, you got to get those easy strikes for the eight-year-olds. Yeah. I wanted to go back to the other carp question. I had, and I don't know if you have heard this too. They're supposedly a DJ at KXLU, like, announced somehow. I don't know how this word got out, but a DJ at KXLU like announced that there was a suicide attempt, or he actually announced it as in he's passed away. Have you ever heard this story?
I've never heard of that before.
Yeah, and I'm trying to find out like how I can't remember. It's in the back of my head, someone just telling me this story. It's like, oh yeah, they announced on KXLU that he had died, and then
KXLU it sounds got like the kind of off. Thing that could easily happen.
But that could easily happen. A college no radio DJ, yeah. Very easily. And then the story was then later they, you know, like then the punishment was KXLU stopped getting promos from all the Pacific Northwest labels. Like, that's a very weird thing to. Okay, so you've never heard that.
No.
I figure if there was audio of it somewhere, that would have gotten out and someone would have told you about it. So it might just be apocryphal, like weird folklore that I've heard.
Sounds
like a bizarre thing.
I mean, I spent 4 years on that project, so yeah. I heard...
I'm sure you heard everything.
I'm not going to say I heard all the stories, but I heard a great quantity of them.
Yeah.
And which is actually really funny about opening night and the theatrical runs, and I completely understand how it happens, but it is still kind of funny to me that, like, you spend X amount of years on these things, and you're every day for years listening to these stories and stuff, and then what happens when you're done, your reward... is to hear more of the stories from everyone that just watched it out of the lobby afterwards. You're like, okay, we're going to hear more of these stories.
Well, I mean, I'm sure did you show it at the Capitol Theater or anything like that?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. How huge. Oh, man.
That was...
a lot of tears.
I was just remembering because the Slitstock did bigger screenings than this, but at that time it was by far the biggest screening I'd ever done. It was 144... people, which is funny to say now because it's not actually that many people. The Slits did like that much like every night for like 30 nights in like the UK, and some of those got up to like 300, but much bigger band. But yeah, and just vocal. I mean, that was a quintessential hometown screening. Like, I almost wish we had taped the audience. I didn't know it was coming, so I had no way of knowing. But it
was like... Is there a theater in Tumwater?
Everybody just like, you know, whoa, yeah. Just really interactive.
I can imagine. And did you have a relationship with those guys?
Yeah. So how does this work? So when I got my band together in 97 was the year... No, we got together in 98. 97 was the year that Carp broke up. Right? So... their subsequent bands we played with because we were doing pretty well in the Northwest. So like The Whip would like open up for us.
Yeah.
Initially.
Right.
And then, and also, big business, you know, quickly eclipse us, of course. But when they first started out, you know, they would come. So, yeah, we knew them. And then Mercy Devils, we played shows with them. And Matt Cody, who would go on to be in big business. And I was just remembering the other day we got a during Mercy Devils time period. This is so Northwest. We went to a house party and got wasted, and then everybody was wrestling out in front of, which is weird because this is back like when people who like sports and people who like music did not mix. My little sister is so funny because she still won't accept it. Like now that it's like okay to like both, my sister's like, no way. My little little riot girl sister, she's just like, absolutely, you cannot like music and football. That is not, because that's how it was. That's,
right.
That's the way it was when we grew up, for sure. But so we were all wrestling in the front yard, and I remember Cody just laid me out, man. He's a good wrestler. I don't suggest anybody that's listening,
don't wrestle that guy.
Cody from Big Business.
So, and then when did you conceptualize that you should, that was it just, was it your thought, like, you know, someone needs to make a carp doc, or how did this kind of formulate the carp doc?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the really interesting, huge, huge takeaways for me from that time period was that people didn't want me to do it.
Oh, really?
A lot of people didn't want me to do it. Not the band, just people in the Northwest, which is funny to think about now because I think it's safe to say that people have really embraced that movie, and people really like it, and have, you know, been happy with it. But totally differently, when I started it, people were like, it's just too part, you know, like
it's too soon, kind of a too soon.
Well, it was not like too soon. It was like too personal.
Okay.
The Northwest is, you know, it's not like this anymore. But you know, the Northwest is very like, they're off in the corner of the country for a reason. It's not an accident. You know what I mean? Culturally, it's a really interesting place to me because it's the farthest place that you can go and still be in the United States. And most of those people walked there, not them, but their ancestors, right? If you've been in the Northwest, like my family has since like, you know, the late 19th century, those people did not get on maybe even a train because they were too poor. You know what I mean? Like a lot of people got to the East Coast, lost a bunch of money, and then walked to the Midwest, lost more money there, and then walked to the West Coast. And that was why they're there. And so people just have this attitude, like, just stay out of it. You know, I was a Northwesterner, but they were just like, this is too personal. Just don't get into it. And I just didn't follow that reasoning. And what I found out, it was a very classic thing with documentary, is that you become a bit like a psychiatrist. And a lot of, not that I could give any like solid medical advice, but just in the sense that they've just been, that ended badly, that story, right? And so you got all these people that are walking, or there's no other way to slice it. It was a really terrible thing in the end that happened. So you got all these people that are walking around and they're just not talking to anybody about it. And they just don't feel good about it. And so here's this guy that they get sort of permission to talk to about it because A, I was a Northwesterner, and B, I was from the music scene, and C, the band was saying like, sure, go ahead and talk to this guy. Then they were just like, oh yeah, I'm just going to unload, you know, lay my burden down, as like the Christians would say, you know, it's just like, just carrying around this heavy thing.
Yeah.
And that's good for people to get it out. And so, yeah, it was, but I think we were able to kind of, it was funny with Chris because Chris was so honest about sabotaging the band and, exploding his own life and all this kind of stuff that I, from a filmmaking standpoint, was like, dude, I cannot end this movie with Chris sucks and Jared is awesome. You know what I mean? Like that can't be the ending, right? Like, let's give you your dignity back, right? Like, what is something cool that we can say about you after we said all this negative stuff? And it was, you know, he couldn't say it, couldn't give it to me. And I ended up, but I knew I needed it. So I ended up going back to the very first interview we did. And he said this one line where he said, I'm one of the 2% that makes it out of heroin alive.
Yeah.
And, or, you know, out of jail or out of, or whatever. And that line was all we needed. People wrote me, and they could always, I could practically like smell these emails now. You look at them, and the first line is like, I am one of that 2%. Where mm-hmm. it's a heroin addict being like, I fucking made it. Mm-hmm. I made it out. And they just gave them so much pride, because they got lots of stuff to feel bad about and not very much stuff to feel good about. And everybody's got to have something to feel good about, mm-hmm. or it's so hard. Mm-hmm. So it became a kind of a really good thing mm-hmm. to give somebody back and just be like, this is, you know, in the end, it sort of made it as cool as Jared joining the Melvins, because they're both statistically like kind of somewhat difficult.
More people, you know, have been in the Melvins.
Yeah. I don't want to go over and say those two things are the same thing, but it's kind of a funny joke.
Yeah. And, I was at that Whip show in Oakland that I think you have footage of. So you might have the entire show on tape somewhere, right?
Oh, yeah. That's like, as I remember it, that's a 7-parter mm-hmm. on YouTube. I think it's on YouTube.
Oh, it's not just on YouTube. Okay.
I think so.
Yeah, I have not gone through. It's like one of those times. I'm like, am I in this? Am I somewhere in the
background?
Yeah,
you can go crowd surfing for yourself. Yeah. I'm in the opening credits.
Oh, you are?
In the show, yeah. And my bandmates as well. Okay.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
So how did you end up working on the Slits documentary? Was that somehow an outgrowth of working on the Carp documentary?
Sort of. I let's see. How did this happen? So a friend of mine that I was playing lots of shows with, Jennifer, was in this band called the Shell Shack.
Yeah, right.
Right.
Yeah.
So FedEx played shows with them.
On the film, right?
Yeah, exactly. FedEx and Shell Shack had played a bunch of shows together. We were total buddies. I lived with them at one point in New York. They wrote a song about me called, I think it's called Bill Badgley, Please Don't Let Me Fade Away, which is cool because it's got my full name
in there. Yeah.
Yeah. And in fact, I left New York for a while and came back, and I went to a show, and there was like this group of like young people like shouting my name, but didn't know who I, but at the same time, like looking at me like, oh, you should leave the show. Like, who are you? Yeah. You're old.
Yeah, I'm up there.
Yeah, totally. So that was kind of rewarding, but yeah. So we were just friends, and I transitioned into filmmaking, and Jennifer had been the tour manager for the Slits in 2010 and, 2005. And, when Ari passed away in 2010, they were sort of knee deep, waist deep, whatever you want to call it, in making a film, but no particular plan. And Jennifer, is not a filmmaker. And so when Ari passed away, she was just really put in like the worst possible position, where she's like grieving the death of this person, and also I have to do this like really like nearly impossible thing. Mm-hmm. And so I just finished Kill All Redneck Pricks. And so she was like, do you want to do this? And I actually said no at first because I was terrified of clearing major label music.
Yeah.
Which is just a money conversation, you know. The carb thing was cool because it was just my own hard will that was going to make it happen or not. But there's no amount of DIY stick-to-itiveness that's going to pay Island a major records. Label.
Yeah.
It's just like the, you know, Goodfellas where he's, fuck you, pay me. Mm-hmm. So you got to figure out how to pay them. And, you know, which is fine, but it's just, you got to figure it out. And so I was like, yeah, I don't know. I don't know if I can do it. And then 2 weeks later, I woke up and I was just like, just, you know, it's too amazing of an opportunity. I mean, one thing is too ridiculous that this hasn't already happened.
Right.
And B, it's ridiculous that you get to do it. And so C, like, just do it. And so I did it. And of course, 3 years later, all of our intense nightmares came true and we lived in a waking hell trying to figure out how to clear this music. But eventually through like luck and happenstance, did end up connecting with the correct people that have the kind of financial juice and not just financial juice, you know, connectivity sort of juice, to make it happen. And we did. And now I work with these people every day.
Music supervisors or
no, licensing? Like financiers and producers and people with scratch that are just like, let's just do this. Like, even though it's like fiscally probably a terrible idea, like, let's just do it anyway.
Yeah. It's good that, I mean, that seems to be a problem that when I talk to other people about like, hey, how come this movie is not available?
It's
how come
money.
This thing? It's always like, money. And like often music rights, like a lot of old TV
Which
shows.
Is money.
Too. It's money.
No, it's about money.
And your
it's
new film has money. The Clash songs in it.
Okay,
so
well,
I don't
know the interesting thing about the Dawn film is that Dawn is an archivist, obviously. It's two big things. One is that Dawn is an archivist. And so he's been making, you know, movies out of his archive for a long time and selling the stuff to other people. As far as I know, I'm pretty confident in saying this. I'm pretty sure that I'm the only person that's ever been handed like a drive with the entire archive on it. It's hundreds of hours. It's like 200 and something hours. And Don was just like blowing the load. You know, he was like, this is a film about me. And I guess, you know, he decided one of the producers has known him for a really long time. I knew him from the Slit Stock. And he was just like, for whatever reason, he was just like, let's just do this. And I'm all in, which is very Don, you know, which you probably could tell from the movie. Like, if Don's in, he's in.
Yeah.
You know, he's not a halfway kind of guy in any way of speaking about him. Yeah, not in dressing, not even in talking, nothing. He's an all for it type of dude. So that was cool because that stuff's so expensive, they charge for it by the second or by the minute, which becomes by the second.
Oh, like if he had charged you a rate, he charges someone else externally.
Not possible.
Right, you couldn't have done it.
Not with the amount of footage that's in that movie, which is a lot. And it was really fun from a cutting perspective because with the Slits, you have to sort of, you know, constantly be of two minds where you're like, so like artistically, what do we want to do? You answer that question for yourself and then you do it. And then you sit down with like a pad of paper and add up like every second and go, now can we afford to do, it's like driving with handcuffs on, you know, it's like, and then maybe a lot of times the answer to that question is no, we cannot afford to do that way. You have to recut it again.
And when you're working on music documentaries, that's like by nature, it's got to have the music in it.
You know, it's upsetting to me, but people just don't care about anything but the archival. I mean, I don't know if that's all the way true, but it certainly feels true. It's definitely true enough to say that you cannot make a music film without archival and expect people to be happy. You must give them as much archival as you have the ability financially and whatever legally to give them, which is why when I watch the Ron Howard Beatles movie, I'm like, okay, he's just bragging. That 8 days a week thing, they never cut to camera hardly ever on anybody. It's just this bath of the most expensive expensive footage in the world. And I was almost like hard for me to watch because I was like, okay, I mean, I understand this is Ron Howard, but I'm like, this is just like, he's just brag. This is just like, look at it. It feels like 90 minutes of like, look what I did.
Is there a project that you have wanted to take on that you just were like, I can't get the backing to do it?
Not so much mm-hmm. because one thing I've always done, even when I played in bands, is that I stayed to me, it's all about work. Mm-hmm. I'm a workaholic. I love work. I never got into drugs or alcohol because I love stress. Like, I don't think I knew that when I was in my 20s. Mm-hmm. And of course I dabbled, but in music, you know, I see all these people like dropping off like flies, you know, into drug and alcohol addiction and stuff. Mm-hmm. And then when I got older and I was looking back and I was like, oh, you're just too like much of an anal white guy for that particularly to have happened because mm-hmm. I just love stress. Like if I get into a situation, which is weird to live in LA where stress hardly even exists.
Oh, well, but it's drive, like, you know,
but it's like, if I get to a situation where stress leaves, I it's the only time I fall apart. Mm-hmm. I immediately have to put stress back on my shoulders. So all that to say is I just want to keep working. So I don't even pay attention to anything that isn't a possible work scenario for me. I don't even think about it. I'm only thinking about what I can actually work on because mm-hmm. I just only want to work.
Well, that was going to bring me to another question about something I just found out you were involved in, which is this documentary center. Which,
oh yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
Like I'm like I was like, wait, he also does what? Like you're making,
yeah.
You made three films, and you're also created a like workshop kind of co-working space, a school.
Yeah, okay. It really is a school. I mean, so the interesting thing with that was that I ran it when I first left New York, where I was making television. I interviewed for a job at a school at a university, and I got it.
Oh,
Washington State.
Okay.
I wanted to get out of New York. I was trying to figure out how to get out of New York. And I got this job and I was like, oh, shit. Okay. Because I thought I was going to have to convince them to hire me. And they were like, nope. The first thing they said is like, this is where you'll be teaching your class. And I was like, oh, okay. So now what do I do for the rest of this interview? I'm not really sure. And then at the end of the interview, they were like, and this is your start date. And they showed me a date that was a calendar year away from the date that it was. And I felt like somebody punched me in the chest. Mm-hmm. I was like, well, what the fuck am I supposed to do for a fucking year before this job starts? So I did what I can't imagine they thought I would do. And I started my own school.
Yeah.
Designed it, every aspect of it, from the ground up, from the paint, the aesthetic, the way it was structured. It is a production office with a kind of a tight artistic aesthetic. And then I wrote a curriculum. Mm-hmm. And it was based on, you know, my experiences making my own stuff and also working in television. And it was a huge success. It was like in this trial run phase in Washington, it was a huge success. It was like we had 70 students in 2 years. It supported itself financially in the first month. Which was bizarre.
Oh, you started it in Washington. You moved back to Washington.
Yeah, I did. I started it in Washington.
In Bellingham?
Tiny town in Bellingham. Yeah. Okay. And we had like a 33% rate of people coming back for three or more classes. Mm-hmm. I kept adding classes because people kept staying. I had people go from 3 minutes. I had three students, which doesn't sound like a lot out of 70, but I was particularly proud that three students made it all the way to 40 minutes, which is really long. Mm-hmm. And it was good stuff. And I had, you know, professionals walk up to me and be like, students did this? And I was like, yeah, sorry, bro. Like, you can just see them get like dashed mm-hmm. faces, like, uh-oh, more competition. But yeah, and so I tried it in LA and it just like immediately failed. Mm-hmm. Like, it's such a tough market here and just a difficult city. And I have to say, anybody... LA is such a much more difficult city to survive in than New York. Anybody that's talking about New York, oh my God, New York is easy, easy, easy compared to LA. Mm-hmm. And I could go on about that forever, which I won't. But, and then it was such a cataclysmic failure in Los Angeles for a myriad of reasons, which none of which I think have anything to do with the core curriculum. Mm-hmm. Because I saw it work. I saw mm-hmm. it work for years. I got funding for film and I just started making films.
Yeah.
And so it just got super backburnered, but I definitely will go back to it. I loved that thing. I had a great time teaching the class and had a great time hanging out there. My professional life has always been wedded with interns.
Okay.
So I've always, from the very beginning of being a professional, have taught. Because the first part of your day, every morning, was like, you know, sitting down with the interns and trying to figure out what it was they could do and helping them do it. So I, to me, it's just a natural part of the production office.
Yeah. So you, I'm sure you met some people through doing it here that you could work with on other stuff or could intern with you, or has that not
been the case?
Oh, no.
I'm not sure.
Yeah. Yeah, no. Did you feel like you had a mentor in filmmaking or,
Yeah. So I, yeah. So what I was trying to get out of the band, I had really long hair, and I had it worn up in like a, this is before the top bun thing was such a joke, and mine wasn't on the top, it was in the back, but, still had this stupid bun and went in to the job interviews, you know, and tattoos and everything. This was in 2008. And I was doing art delivery in a truck in New York, which is essentially you're like a kind of a glorified truck driver. I did that for 6 years. When I was in a band, driving around the five boroughs, which is a whole nother story. Anyway, I was like, I got to get out of this. I was almost going to turn 30, and I was just watching all these people. Like, you know, music is a tough business to grow old in. And I wasn't even interested in trying. I was just like, I don't even want to do this. I want to keep telling stories. This is not the way I want to do it. I want out. And so I had thought about film school. It was so expensive and it didn't seem worth it. And I seen, I thought of internships as something that only rich kids could do, cause you don't get paid. So I was like, I don't know what to do. And then somebody said, well, you know, you leave and you go to tour and you don't make any money for that. So what's the difference between doing an internship? And I was like, oh, okay. So I said, I can afford to lose. I was like, that makes sense. Yeah. I can afford to work one less day than I am. So I wrote 50 emails the saying that I could do an internship one day a week. And I got one reply back, and I got back from this production company called Punched in the Head, which is operated by this guy named Craig Dentrone. And he was a, basically like a predator, producer, shooter, editor that was showing up. Yeah. It's a cool badass kind of term. Yeah. It just was way more badass than it actually is. Not a hitman.
Yeah.
No. And so he was starting his first company making shows for MTV, a show called True Life. And he was like the perfect person to work for because, much to his own chagrin, I'm sure, he couldn't help but train you how to do everything because he never had a company before and it was his first time. And he was just accidentally showing you how to do everything because that was what he'd been doing on his own for 10 years. So he was great. So I spent a little over 2 years with him constantly. Traveling around America, shooting stuff, working in the office,
doing MTV, everything. And, yeah,
then, and then like the, you know, the Yoda thing, I left like, your training is not over. And I'm like, see ya, you know, took off and then went and fought, you know, slayed my own dragons. And they definitely are formidable foes, I have to say, but ended up surviving maybe almost kind of on accident.
And this is, you're still in New York when this is all happening? Yeah. Or no, you when did you move back to the West Coast?
I think I'm trying to remember. I think it was in between Kill All Redneck Pricks and the Slits film. Yeah. Yeah, totally.
Yeah. Working on, we don't think that much about how reality TV informs like documentary or like how they're kind of in the same world.
Well, one of the big things I think about that, just even that term, is that it's a sort of a garbage bin terminology for too many different things.
Right. And in fact, with podcasts, I guess.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah. And one of the classes I pitched that I was so upset they didn't take me up on was this thing where we just talk about, just open up this casket of this word and being like, what is this shit?
Because like documentary or reality?
No, TV. reality TV. Yeah. Because at that time, I think it would have been a more, maybe an interesting conversation than now, but just this idea that reality TV is this term that they give to stuff that goes all the way from being like quite legitimate documentary on one side of it to being scripted.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Like literally scripted. Like, and every variable in between, and then this huge viewership that cannot tell the difference between what's going on. And so they don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, it's very dangerous that you wouldn't know what's going on. And I don't know. It's just very deep water, I think.
Yeah, just to like break down what it is, that what the audience expectations are, just like, like maybe it's just like a truth in advertising in a certain way.
From the filmmaker point of view, was that what I wanted to do was talk about, take these parts, these shows part that sort of represent the spectrum and sort of show people how they're put together so that they could see what I like to call relative truth.
Mm-hmm.
There's, you know, anybody who's an adult knows that there isn't truth and untruth. There's so much more complicated than that, you know, is that there's this idea of like relative truth, that the whole, you know, defining element of being an adult is knowing the answer to every question is yes and no, which is the most annoying thing about being a kid. You know, you're like, how does this work? And they're just like, oh God, it's like 17 different things. And you're like, can you just tell me one? They're like, no.
Yeah.
But, you know, so just kind of like opening up those things and so that people could decide. But I think ultimately nobody cares.
Mm-hmm. They just become entertainment kind of.
Well, and the dangerous responsibility that we all take on our shoulders when we do this stuff is that the better job that you do, the less anybody thinks that you did it.
Mm-hmm.
So the better I make a movie or anybody makes a movie, and I notice this all the time, the more they're just like, imagine that I just sat there and did nothing and that this is just true.
Mm-hmm.
And I just like tripped over it like it's a rock in a field, which just could not be farther from the truth.
The invisible hand.
They're always crafted.
Yeah.
Always. Mm-hmm. Is that the documentarian's art is an art of exclusion and an art of inclusion. So you're constantly going around the subject and saying, this is important and this is not important.
Mm-hmm.
And that's crafting.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? This is relative truth. Like I don't set out to deceive anyone, but I'm a human being and all of these people are. And anybody tells you that they're presenting an absolute undeniable truth. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
That's a Bible salesman.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe, now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
This episode is brought to you by Philo. Do you love TV? Do you love saving money? Then Philo is your solution. Philo has shows, movies, and live TV for just $25 a month. You can even try it for free with their 7-day free trial. No contracts, no commitments, no hassles. Just a better way to watch TV. Never miss a minute of shows like the hit docuseries Where is Wendy Williams? Or classics such as Friends. If you can't get enough TV, then there's no better way to watch. Philo has more than 70 channels like BET, MTV, and AMC. And the best part? You can try it yourself with their 7-day free trial. Sign up today at philo.tv/poppods. That's philo.tv/poppods to get 50% off your first month.
Yes, 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 y'all. 1-2-1 in the place. This is Seaball in the Star Trek. We're talking to Kim Dean in the movie Fox. We're about to rock off your socks. Big audio line. Hit it!
With this Don Letts film, what's kind of the process it's going to go through? Like, you're just going to keep editing and stuff and then try to get a release, get a theatrical
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah,
I guess I don't know a lot of the process of that stuff. I mean, well, did you with Kilometric Pricks? Did you do like Indiegogo or like fundraising?
No, I don't do crowdsourcing.
None of that stuff.
Okay. It was incorrectly reported about the Slitstock that it was a crowdfunded film.
Yeah, I think I saw something in the credits was confused. Yeah, no, it seemed like
all.
It. Okay,
not at all.
No,
And I have zero interest in crowdfunding.
It's so it seems like a pain. Yeah,
despise it really. It's I probably shouldn't say that, but I just don't
go to our Patreon.
Yeah, exactly. I just don't want to ask permission to do a project.
Okay, right. Feel beholden to someone.
And I just don't, I'm going to do it regardless.
Yeah.
I've decided to do it, I'm going to do it. And then it's my job to figure out how we do it.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't like to be in a situation where at the end of it, they go, oh, well, everybody said you can't do this.
Right.
I don't know
how common that is with those kind of crowdfundings, but I mean,
we failed cataclysmic. We tried it.
Oh, you did try it.
With the Slitstock. Uh-huh. And it was, I didn't want to do it. Mm-hmm. And then we did it and it failed twice.
Oh.
And I'll never do it again.
Oh, you mean like it didn't hit its targets and stuff.
Right. Yeah, so the Kickstarter we did first and it just completely failed. We were asking for $30,000, which is not enough money.
Yeah.
And it failed at 14.5.
Mm.
And then we did it again with Indiegogo where you can select that, you know, now we were like, oh, we see this trick coming. So we selected, you know, keep whatever you may thing and made like $3,000. So it didn't, you know, very, very little. So then I just went back to my original thinking was just like, it's a much tougher, well, I don't know if it's tougher. They're all the roads are tough.
Mm-hmm.
But I just decided I liked it better, I guess, is to go out and just find film financing companies.
Right. I think like some record labels kind of have their name on that film.
Yeah, they did.
Like Recess and Star Cleaners.
Yeah. They don't represent the lion's share of the funding.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, they did pitch in. Did get their names on there. I also wouldn't do that anymore.
Okay, yeah. But it makes, I guess, in the sense that Star Cleaners is like Jennifer's associated.
Yeah,
with
no,
that,
it
right?
was totally fun. And sense, I mean, they, you know, it was amazing that it happened for that project. I just, you know, it's, films are such a pain in the ass and are so expensive.
Right.
That I just think it's better for everybody just to like go with people that are just like, this is not their first rodeo.
Gotcha. Okay, I see what you're saying.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, well, you're dealing with a film finance company.
Mm-hmm.
They get it. Mm-hmm. They don't, like, you don't have conversations where they go, why is this taking so long? And you're just like, actually, this is going really fast. But they don't know that.
Right.
Because that's an interesting thing for music films, because when you talk to a musician, a film to a musician is never anything more than a slow record.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what
right.
I mean?
Yeah.
Because their whole mind is centered around a record, which takes a certain amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
And then a film is like, doesn't matter if you're doing this 2 to 3 times faster than someone else. Mm-hmm. It's never, you're never going to make a film as fast as anyone is going to make a record.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Unless you're really heavily screwing around.
Yeah.
So, you know what I mean? So it's like, there's always that sort of difficulty thing where they're just like, I don't get it.
Well, that's what's interesting, because I feel like you come from this sort of DIY background. So it's like, where does a DIY person like hit a wall? It's when you have to deal with like this massive financing stuff, right?
Major
it's
levels.
Like, it's like, you know how to make stuff cheaply and efficiently. And then when you have to deal with like sort of the distribution and the...
I mean, there's
the
two separate answers for that. Okay, one is major labels.
Mm-hmm.
There's a couple different answers. Two is not doing everything yourself.
Mm-hmm.
I survived the first couple of films by not hiring anyone.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Right.
But that's a limited thing. I mean, that essentially is a martyrdom.
Right.
Right.
Well, that's what I think we think of like 90s indie film or like Robert Rodriguez with like a chair as a dolly or whatever, you know, that kind of stuff.
No, it's total. Yeah. Well, and it goes way beyond. Mm-hmm. I mean, it goes like, I gave up everything to do this, I have to say.
The first film?
All of them.
All of them. Okay.
You know, it's, I mean, literally like put back cheese.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh, we can't afford, like that cheese is nice. we can't afford to eat that. We're not eating that. Like, nothing. I mean, you just give up everything. You give up time. You give up money. You give up everything. And a lot of people are just not willing to do that. Going out, I didn't go out. You know, you just make these decisions. But my point is that that's what it requires to make a film on no money. But, you know, hopefully as things go on, you inspire enough confidence in the people with money. And thing about people with money is they don't like to lose it. they get to the point where they're like, maybe Bill won't lose our money. And then they go, okay, well then let's give him a little bit more. And then each time you get a little bit more, and then each time you hire a little bit more people, and then you get a little bit more of your own life back. Like I have a girlfriend for the first time in like years, you know, they'd be like actually like theoretically possible that I could like carve out a part of my mind to someone else. You know, you get a little bit of your own life back every time. But then also I think you reduce the amount of years, you know, that you have to give to a film. It's just whenever anybody says like, oh, this film took 4 years, the film took 5 years, barring the idea that they have no idea what they're doing, which is probably not it, it's the fact that the first thing I think of when I hear that is nights and weekends. Is that somebody is trying to like, it's like swimming through shark infested waters with a baby on your back. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, how do I keep my head above ground or above water and do like 8 full-time jobs at the same time, which is making a film. It's not easy. So it takes like years and years. So that, and then, you know, once you get more money, you can get paid, which means that you just wake up in the morning and just go to one job, which is a huge turning point. It was weird for me because I started out doing that, doing that TV, and then wanting, you make a bunch of money in TV, and then wanting to leave to make my own movies. And then it was a real slap in the face when it was like, oh, but nobody's going to hire you to make films. So you have to start again from the ground up. That was really tough.
Like that skill set that you got was not.
They're just two different. I wouldn't know if I didn't say that. What I would say about it is that they're just, you know, people are human. They live in tribes, and those are just two different tribes. TV and film.
Right.
I could have kept working in TV, of course. I knew tons of people. But, you know, they don't translate. Those connections don't go over. So you're on your own, which is a very American sort of thing as an artist anyway.
How are you feeling about working with like distribution with like Amazon and Hulu and the streaming services and stuff like that? I mean, those films got their theatrical runs. Like you had to book that in a very DIY way, right?
So I self-financed that movie, self-released it, showed it to 70 countries and
Rentals? You have to like...
No, I do not do rentals.
Door deals kind of basically?
Only do door deals.
Yeah, okay.
Only do... That was a huge thing. And a really interesting thing between Carp and Slits is that when I did the Carp thing, they, being the theaters, they were like, we want you to take the hit. And we're like, oh, surprise, surprise. They were like, we want you to rent us. So we take no risk and you take all risk. And I'm like, sounds like an unappealing offer offered.
No.
So I didn't do it. And I just sort of, you know, so I went a lot of unconventional routes on that first one. Did a lot of theaters, but did backs of bars, which a lot of times sucks. Just because of noise. And uncomfortable chairs. And did that sort of thing. And then with Slits, it was all normal theaters. And in the time period between the two, I think 2 theaters out of like 80 in 2 countries, in the UK and in the United States, were like, we want you to rent. And I was like, no, 50-50. And in fact, most of them didn't fight me on the 50-50. One or two wanted to do 30-70. And I think I agreed to one because it was the second time in that city But I made it really clear that I wasn't really happy about it, so much so that they became unhappy with me that I was unhappy with them about it. But I was just like, to me, it's worth making the point that it should be even. You have a theater, I have a movie.
Yeah.
They're really hard to make.
Yeah.
You know, like, period.
I want to see people do stuff like at the Los Feliz 3. I think they're just doing rentals. Like, I talked to Brett about this. Like,
I have never
a rental.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because the same guy, I think, owns Vista.
I think so. Yeah. They're kind of in the same
website. And I believe, yeah. I know it's a rental, but I think it's also a buyout.
Oh, okay.
Of what would have been there.
A buyout. Okay, right. So you just have to pay as if it was a sold out screening.
Yeah,
for,
I mean,
like,
don't quote me, but this
movie
is what I believe.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I'm already quoted, obviously.
Yeah. And I'm sure, like, when you do that kind of tour with a film, you have to, like, figure out how to do your own PR, you hire a publicist, or you do.
Well, I mean, the thing that's interesting is that it's got to be event based, right?
Your Q&A or something.
Yeah. And people, it's an interesting thing to me that people say this thing that I think is very confusing for other people that are interested in getting into the conversation is they say, do you have distribution? What does that mean? There's no, that's ridiculous.
It's like the record problem
it's
again.
It's a ridiculous question. I mean, it's just not like a distribution. It's like a fairy godmother that walks into the room and like taps a stick on your head. And now your film is in every hand on every device. I mean, it probably works that way for like Brad Pitt. I'm sure it does. Obviously it does. But, for no one else, you know what I mean? Like certainly no one on my level. It would be a more accurate question to be like, do you have distributions? Because there's like five different deals for every territory, you know, streaming, theatrical, physical, there's all this different stuff. And so you approach each one completely separately. Like, so in the United States, we were on Hulu, but I also did my own theatrical and in fact didn't want anyone to take the theatrical because they don't do anything with it typically.
Yeah. And it's a niche, and like the first film, like it's like, you know, the people that you want to reach out to get in the theater.
My understanding is that if somebody buys it, it usually would just be lumped in with streaming and then they would just use it, as a sort of a PR device for the do six or seven shows. And I completely get it. I mean, I fault them in no way. I totally makes sense. Because I only do touring because I toured my whole life.
Right. Yeah.
And so to me, it's just like, you know, you finish a record, you go on tour. You finish a movie, you go on tour. And so you find out what happened, you know, from being isolated at your desk for all those years. And you walk around the country, literally, and talk to people. And I also go to all my tours on foot as well. So I'm literally walking around.
Really?
Like planes, trains, automobiles.
Yeah.
Rental car. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't drive around like a band would do. And so, and I stay at people's houses. So it's like, I love it and I didn't want anybody to take it.
Do you make some kind of ancillary merch or something? Like some kind of merch?
I always have regular merch.
Yeah. Yeah. Like DVDs and.
Yeah. You take all that stuff. So it's like, you know, I wanted to do that. I don't know how long I'll get to keep doing that because ultimately it becomes a decision of like, well, do you want to do this or do you want to make another movie? Because you can't only be in one place at one time.
Right. Yeah.
So we'll see how that progresses in the future. But I really enjoy it. And it's just part of my sort of DNA.
And you said you were spending a lot of time in the UK. Does John Letts live in the UK? Is most of the interviews all shot over there?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Pretty much everything but the adult reenactments were shot in the UK. Adult reenactments were shot here in Los Angeles.
Oh, so the kid was
Echo
in
Park.
England. Okay.
Yeah, the kid had to be in England because the kid talks.
Oh, right.
I wasn't going to try to have an American do a British accent.
Yeah, well, like an 8-year-old American kid.
Or an adult.
Yeah.
What I like to say about those accents is they only go one way across
right.
the pond.
That's true, know? Yeah. Like, yeah, Cumberbatch can do anything, but then, yeah. So you're going to probably do a lot of touring or at least I think that Don Letts is a very known guy in the UK.
Oh,
compared to here.
Yeah, oh, for sure.
Yeah.
And that was part of the reason why I wanted to title it the way we titled it, Rebel Dread, because I think the conversation in the UK is, do you want to watch a film about Don Letts? And I think the conversation in the United States is, do you want to watch a movie about a Rebel Dread? which is different.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like, because I think Americans would be more likely to be like, yeah, watch a movie about a rebel dread. Mm-hmm. Whereas like, do you want to watch a movie about Don Letts? The U.S., they're like, if you catch me up on who we're talking about. You yeah. know? Like, they just
yeah.
don't know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And he was, yeah, and he's a really interesting dude. That's like, just a small, very minor. Obviously, you saw the potential in doing this. So you obviously like knew that you were working with something with this guy.
Yeah, so, yeah. I mean, you know, obviously there's a big race thing in the film. Mm-hmm. And to me, that was, I mean, you know, I don't think it's ever worth it to make a film about a band that's like just cool. Mm-hmm. You know, they're too difficult for that. It can't be like, well, why do you want to do this? I'm like, those guys wore some really sweet pants. Like, that's just not.
This is a lot of music documentaries. So
yeah, I mean, it's just not enough. Yeah. I mean, there has to be like a deeper tendril into something that can make people's lives better.
Well, yeah, The Slits is a lot about feminism, or even if they didn't term themselves that, it's about that missing part of the dialogue about punk is like the role women had in it, and also just. How, and then with Killer Redneck Pricks, it's sort of like mental health, addiction, and just friendship. I mean, I and stuff.
I feel like that movie's just like love.
Yeah, yeah.
It's about like being in love, mm-hmm. like with what you're doing and who you're doing it with, mm-hmm. and all the sort of ugliness that goes along with all that beauty. Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. There's got to be something like that. And even all the projects that we have lined up for the future, it just doesn't work, and it's just not worth it mm-hmm. if there isn't one of those things. And as time goes on, I'm starting to realize that my thing is personal freedom. I mean, like we were talking before about grunge, you know, people need like lots of opportunities to exist. And because we're sort of pack animals, it means opening up new channels where you go, hey, you group, come on, you know, come on board. Let's, you know, give you permission to be you. Mm-hmm. And I just find that so unbelievably important. And it was one of the first things that really drew me to the Don story is that it's a story of inclusion. Mm-hmm. And the biggest sort of takeaway for me is that punk being this ultimate invitation to step over whatever is in front of you, is in your way. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the reason it's become so big.
Like as punk is sort of like as a verb kind of, or exactly. like a means of approaching.
And I know Don's really into this too, is this idea that if you think punk is a sound, you are grossly misunderstanding what's going mm-hmm. on here.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, you are in no way getting the most of what you can get out of this.
Yeah. I've always sort of abided by that. I think that's true. I mean, if you really want to play like the maximum rock and roll kind of like, you know, game.
Sure.
Like,
I mean, yeah.
What, you know, this fine. doesn't
end there.
A guitar. What's going on?
You know? Yeah, like, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And I know Don, that's been a huge thing Don's been talking about for years. Mm-hmm. And so I really, really agree with that. Mm-hmm. Really feel that that's incredibly important. And I think it's fairly stated the first minute of the film.
Yeah.
Where it's just like, you know, it's the invitation to be yourself, mm-hmm. you know, and to turn problems into assets. And as Don says, you know, as a first generation British born black, mm-hmm. that's something I know a lot about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it seems like you've like taken whatever you've gotten from this really DIY community and methodology, and you've applied some of that into like how you it seems like that's the narrative that maybe people bring up. It's like, oh, is a punk guy doing punk docs, you know?
I always approach it from the standpoint of what it feels like to be in the band. Mm-hmm. Because that's my vantage point. Is that I made the car film because I knew that I had to sort of say goodbye to my brothers mm-hmm. that I'd spent my whole time with. So much so that I didn't even know who I was if they weren't standing there. I mean, it's a huge thing that I don't, you know, and I'd love to do a film that centers more on this. We haven't done it yet, but it's that absolute crisis, personal crisis mm-hmm. that happens to you when your band is over. You don't know who you are. It's like somebody in the crop talk said, your last name is the name of your band. Right. You literally don't have a name
Joey anymore. Ramone, yeah. It reminds me of something, I think, I want to say it's in this book. I think it's Sam McPheeters, maybe, quote about like, in our generation, instead of going to war, we started bands. Like, it's like,
very
there's
much,
something
yeah.
like that's a good generationally one. Yeah. bonding about, and like, I completely, it's like this kind of familial relationship that's not a blood relationship. It's not even chosen family because the band breaks up.
That's why I purposefully mix the social terminology when I talk about CARP is because I think it's a really important distinction that the one that I hear you starting to make is that the band thing is sort of equal parts, you know, family, friend, lover, whatever.
Business partner.
Yeah, exactly. Business partner, but also none of those things.
Right, yeah.
You know, so it's like this really interesting kind of dynamic. And I'm just not a music nerd, and I don't find music factoids interesting. So I just don't approach them from that. And I think I catch some amount of flack for that. But
what's a music film that you feel like you really aspired to? And then maybe one that you like, maybe not to say you talk shit on it or anything, just like something where like, I don't want to fall into the trap that this music film fell into.
I'm trying to remember from for the primary question or the first question.
Okay, yeah, just more like what is an inspiration?
We Jam Okano.
Yes.
I think was one of the first. And CARP film got compared to We Jam Okano a lot. Just be
three guys that everyone knows about.
Yeah, yeah, that nobody knows about. That it was
more influential than their popular.
That was about
yeah.
friendship, not about a band.
Right.
Really, I mean, at the heart of it. And We Jam Okano is a great movie.
Yeah.
You know, and I was honored to ever be in the same sentence as that film, ever. Still am. And so I think that film, to me, was like one of the first ones that, you know, but I think I don't know. Like, I just think about people. I make music films because that's what people are interested in talking to me about. And I feel like I can have some kind of insight on it. But I really only think about people. I watch a lot of narrative films. And I watch documentaries, but I watch way more narrative films than I watch.
Yeah, me too. And I have a podcast about documentaries.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I actually wanted to ask you how your podcast got started and why.
So my co-host, who's not here, he had one day, he has a lot of free time. He just like decided to watch like some like Time or someone made a list of the top 100 documentaries you should watch. And he's just like, I'm just going to watch one of these every day. So he got deep into it.
Of 100?
Yeah, I think he watched, like, there's this top 100 list. I have to look. I haven't seen most of
these.
Wow,
that's really what they call a deep dive.
Yeah. I've always liked, I took a class on documentaries before. I kind of, like, cut together something way back in the day on, like, VHS decks.
Oh, wow.
But, yeah, it was way back in the day. And they did literally some film classes. Yeah. It was like, I don't know. I don't remember what the, it was like basically like making a mixtape, you know?
Yeah, yeah, sure.
So, and then everyone would switch to software the year after that. So I'm like, well, that was, I guess.
You're like,
not
now I know how to do nothing.
Yeah, exactly. But really, I did, probably should have stuck with it, but I don't know. Anyway, no, I've always been a fan of like these kind of Americana weird, like one of my favorite movies we got to cover is Project Grizzly. I don't know if you've seen that film. It's about a guy who wants to research grizzly bears, so he creates a suit.
The suit?
Yeah.
I didn't know there was a feature on this guy.
Yeah, it was made by the Canadian Film Board, so it's like this like insane.
Oh,
it's,
wow.
It's a comedy.
I'm sure.
Like basically like these docs are like kind
of
like
I immediately thought
so
of Winnebago Man.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Which I have not actually seen Winnebago Man. I'm actually like, yeah, like I kind of fell into this like co-host role of like, I think I have some ideas about this. And then we've been doing more. It's easier for me to do these interviews with documentary filmmakers in L.A., being that I'm down here.
Oh, where is he?
Co-host in San Francisco. But he was down here for a while.
So is he going to make an appearance on this, like, after the fact?
No,
just not this you
one.
And I.
Well, because also I talked to, he was here last week, and we were trying to get that together, and he's like, you know, I don't know these bands. I don't know if I want, I'm like,
oh,
yeah.
Sure.
And then I totally know.
You do, obviously.
I saw CARP.
Yeah.
I didn't see the Slits. I saw Ari Up in New York in the year 2000.
Just causing a scene.
It like Brownies. Oh, if you play? Remember that place. And it was like, I think the Chick 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 guys had just moved to New York from Sacramento.
Yeah, I used to live in a warehouse.
Oh, really? With those guys. So like they were there and I was there. And I think that was it to see like Ari with like maybe the same singer who ends up being in the later Slits. And I just remember her unfurling the dreadlock from the top of her head and then just like helicoptering it around the floor of Brownies because there was only like eight of us. So it wasn't going to hit anyone. And that was like my one time. And Debbie Harry was there.
Oh, shit.
Debbie Harry was there. That was it was like me, Chick Chick Chick, and Debbie Harry watching Harry up.
Wow.
It was pretty ridiculous.
What was Debbie doing?
She just like was in there for a while. Then she like walked away. And I'm like, she has the biggest head.
Oh, really?
Like, she's a tiny person. She kind of
looks like it.
Yeah, she's like a really small woman.
With a huge head.
With a big face. A huge face.
Beautiful, like round Danish face.
Yeah. And then we were all just like looking at each other, kind of like flipping out a little bit. Like, we're in New York. And this is Debbie Harry's here at the Ari Up show. And there's only like eight of us.
I saw Bjork in a bar in a very similar sort of circumstance where it's like 13 people in this bar that's about the size of your apartment.
Yeah.
And I was sitting at the bar and I looked over and I'm like, oh, that girl's really pretty. And I'm like, she looks a lot like, she's wearing a full-length kimono. And then I look back and I'm like, she looks like Bjork.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm drinking. I'm like, that is Bjork. And she asked for directions. Well, my friend was like, bullshit, it's not Bjork. And I was like, well, when she opens her mouth, we're going to know because that is not a very common accent. And
it was scripted.
She leaned in between the two of us and asked the bartenders for direction to the cab stand in the cutest little Icelandic accent, which I will not
I just tried to do. It was terrible. Yeah.
But so luckily for me, the bartender gave sort of shoddy directions. So I was like, I wasn't going to talk to her unless I had something to say, but now I did because he gave these terrible directions. So I was like, actually, you can't see it when you go outside. You have to walk around. Anyway, she looked at me with this like intense eyes, which is just like really strong, fierce eyes. And she's asking me some questions about it, which I answered. And then at the end, she's like, okay. And she pulls on this jacket that's completely white, made out of beads and feathers, and looks just when you thought she couldn't look any more insane, and then just walks out into the ghetto in the middle of the night. And I was like, turned to my friends, I'm like, no one will ever see Bjork again.
Oh no. like a swan in the
that
city.
That neighborhood in Brooklyn at that time, people called it the dead zone. Because it was just miles of roll downs Broadway at that time of night.
But I wonder if people gave her a clear berth or something. In a weird way, actually, I feel like I'm sure Ari Up was like looking at Bjork and being like, she gets away with it. She can do whatever.
Oh, I'm sure.
Like she does the weird outfits and the. Yeah, but I mean, her vibe seemed very. Very different vibe altogether. Did you ever interact with Ari? And
I did. I got to meet her a few times. Uh-huh. The weirdest one was the first one because I lived in a punk house in Portland for a year, Oregon, in 2006. Mm-hmm. I took a year off in New York and I woke up and she was in my living room because it was an old punk house, been going on, still going on, but probably not for much longer, the way that Portland's
doing. Yeah, the way
Portland's so punk now, they can't have a punk house.
Yeah.
Which is funny. And then, but this punk house has been going on for like 20 years or whatever, maybe 25 years now. And the woman that ran it just brought them home. You know, they brought bands were there all the time. So just woke up and Tess, who I became really close with eventually, we worked on the movie together, and Ari sitting there. And then I met her again in Brooklyn and I think it was funny, like for me, the way we ended up handling her death in the film, was that she's basically more or less missing in the first part, right? People talk about her and all this kind of stuff. And then she just kind of whirlwinds in and takes over the whole entire movie for like 20 minutes.
Because you have all that footage, right? That Jennifer shot.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So when it catches up to 2005, she just like whirls in and like, you know. But that, to me, is exactly like it is in real life of meeting her, where it's like the first thing I thought when I met her was like, whatever was previously going on in this room is now now over.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's completely over. In fact, no one can even remember what was going on in this room before Ari walked into it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a little bit like that in the movie. She just kind of like magics in and just takes everything over.
Totally. I totally got that sense. But I was just thinking about how like young she was when she started all that stuff. I mean, like, I didn't realize that she was like 14 when that band started.
Well, it's one of the cool things about, you know, is that obviously, you know, you hear a lot about women living in a symbolic world of like, you know, these male rock. But Ari was literally living in a world of male rock stars. Her mom was a promoter in Germany. Mm-hmm. She remembered Jimi Hendrix as the guy in the living room, right?
Yeah.
Later, she was quoted as later on, she's like, I knew he had a band, but I didn't know what it was called.
The Jimi Hendrix.
Yeah, because Jimi Hendrix was just a friend of her mom.
Yeah.
And it doesn't end there. There's lots of other, you know, yes. Like, there's mm-hmm. a lot of those bands. And then, you know, when they made it to London, there were all those bands mm-hmm. and all those people. And so Ari was literally like, Viv tells this great story about, didn't end up being in the film, but it's a great line where she goes, you know, we would go to these parties and we'd go over to the house and there'd be like a little girl that would like do the pirouette for everybody before she's sent off to bed.
Mm-hmm.
And then we stay up and party, and that was Ari.
Yeah, yeah. That's totally, and then the people partying just happen to be like Joe Strummer and stuff.
Yeah, because yeah. so she's insane. Just like, because like the little kids do before their parents stay up and drink brandy with their dinner guests or whatever, is they just like, you know, you do your little entertainment piece.
Yeah.
And then get sent upstairs to, you know, off to bed.
I guess that's what made me actually think about Bjork just then, because she was in a band when she was like 12 or 13 too. Like Kukul was like a band that was like on Crass Records.
Okay.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So like when I think about how young are, and then also think about the fact that I have that album cover, I'm just like, do I have an album cover with a naked girl under 18 like in my record collection?
Yeah.
And maybe in England that was.
And my door is gonna get kicked in at any like, moment. I've never thought about that.
I just thought of it last night when I watched that. I'm like,
that's so
funny. Man, I did not even think of that.
It is different in England.
Yeah, it might be because I remember 16. The Bow Wow Wow.
Because it's 16 in England, also, not Annabelle, 18.
Oh, it was 16. And then Annabelle from Bow Wow was like naked on her album cover too, which is another Malcolm McLaren.
Well, I hope you don't get arrested, but I can't guarantee it.
I shouldn't at this point. I was not the original purchaser of Cut. Well, Bill, this has been a real interesting, fun time talking to you about
absolutely. Thanks
music.
For having me.
I mean, I feel like we music nerded out a little bit.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. You know, so you can find How to Be Here to Be Heard on Hulu.
Yeah.
And you can find Kill Redneck Pricks on Amazon.
Yep.
And Rebel Dread.
Nowhere yet,
but it's 2019 somewhere.
Yeah.
You feel like you're...
Oh, yeah.
What percentage would you say
We're replacing like footage, like mm-hmm. photos with higher quality photos and doing a lot of our legal stuff. Mm-hmm. When that's done, I always take it as an opportunity to sneak in one more creative edit, which is why I did that in progress mm-hmm. the other night to be like, you know, what can we do to make this even better?
Mm-hmm.
And so I'll be sneaking that in and then, yeah, then we go through the whole rigmarole, find a premiere and then start, you know, the sales guy, my producing partner, Mark Venice from Movie House, start taking it out mm-hmm. and talking around.
Yeah.
But yeah, we'll go and do all that stuff and, should be good. And we have lots of stuff lined up for next year to make.
Oh, okay. Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, best of luck with everything.
Thank you.
We would love to take your documentary class sometime. Maybe we'll make a podcast of it or something.
Yeah. I mean, hopefully get that going, get a moment to get that going again, come back, talk about that. I could easily talk about that for an hour.
Yeah. I have like two ideas that I'll talk to you off mic about, which I think could be really interesting.
For sure.
All right. Bill Badgley, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. You can find out more about SupDoc at supdocpodcast.com. And follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook.
And please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe on iTunes.
Our theme song was written by David Siegel, and our show was engineered by Will Scoville.
If you want us to cover a doc, have suggestions for guests, or you just want to reach out, please email us at supdocpodcast@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you.